and I view my future with mixed feelings. Whatever became of my childhood ambitions, joining the Space Patrol, winning a gold medal at the Olympics, climbing Mount Everest alone in my bathing suit, sustained only by my indomitable will and strange psychic arts learned from Hindu mystics. The saddest words of tongue or pen are something or other, what might have been, I think. I light up a cigar and settle down to write another chapter of the Warlord of Saturn's Moons. A filthy habit, you say? Though I'm not sure if you're referring to smoking cigars or writing science fiction. True, I reply. But both activities are pleasurable, and we maiden ladies lead lives that are notoriously short on pleasure. So back I go to the domes of Titan and my red-headed heroine death-raying down the warlord's minions. The smell of burning flesh, the spectacle of blackened bodies collapsing. Even on paper, it gets a lot of hostility out of you, so that your nights aren't troubled by dreams of murder. Terribly unrestful, those midnight slaughters, and waking, shaking in the darkness, your hands still feeling pressure from grabbing the victim or fighting off the murderer. Another escape! In a power sledge, my heroine races across Titan's methane snow, and I go and make myself tea.
You are entering a zone of sound and imagery. A landscape of frequency. A vocabulary of modulation. There is the signpost up ahead. Please adjust your chronometers. This is Gremlin Time.
Welcome to Gremlin Time. This is Fortunato. We have Professor Kitty with us once again. Hi.
Hello, Fortunato.
Hey. Today we're going to present a couple of science fiction stories. And the first one is by Eleanor Arneson?
Correct.
We'll just get right into it right now. This is a story called The Warlord of Saturn's Moons.
There's a paper on the kitchen table, waiting to tell me all about yesterday's arsons, rapes, and bloody murders. Quickly, I stuff it into the garbage pail. Outside, the sky is hazy. Another high pollution day, I think. I can see incinerator smoke rising from the apartment buildings across the street, which means there's no air alert yet. Unless, of course, they're breaking the law over there. I fling open a cabinet and survey the array of teas. Earl Grey, I ponder. Assam, gunpowder, jasmine, genmai ka, or possibly an herb tea. Sassafras, mint, Irish moss, or moo. Deciding on Assam, I put the water on, then go back to write an exciting chase through the icy Titanian mountains. A pursuer's sledge goes over a precipice, and as my heroine hears this long shriek on her radio, my tea kettle starts shrieking. I hurry into the kitchen. Now I go through the tea-making ceremony, pouring boiling water into the pot, sloshing the water around and pouring it out, measuring the tea in, pouring more boiling water on top of the tea. All the while, my mind is with my heroine, smiling grimly as she pilots the power sledge between bare cliffs. Above her in the dark sky is the huge crescent of Saturn, a shining white line slashing across it, the famous rings. While the tea steeps, I wipe off a counter and wash a couple of mugs. I resist a sudden impulse to pull the newspaper out from among the used tea leaves and orange peelings. I already know what's in it. The Detroit murder count will exceed 1,000 again this year. The war in Thailand is going strong. Most of Europe is out on strike. I'm far better off on Titan with my heroine, who is better able to deal with her problems than I am to deal with mine. A deadly shot. She has also learned strange psychic arts from Hindu mystics, which give her great strength, endurance, mental alertness, and a naturally pleasant body odor. I wipe my hands and look at them, noticing the bitten fingernails, the torn cuticles, My heroine's long, slender, strong hands have 2-inch nails filed to a point and covered with a plastic paint that makes them virtually unbreakable. When necessary, she uses them as claws. Her cuticles, of course, are in perfect condition. I pour myself a cup of tea and return to the story. Now my heroine is heading for the mountain hideout where her partner waits. A tall, thin, dour fellow with one shining steel prosthetic hand. She doesn't know his name, and she suspects he himself may have forgotten it. He insists on being called 409, his number on the prison asteroid from which he has escaped. She drives as quickly as she dares, thinking of his long face, burned almost black by years of strong radiation on Mars and in space, so the white webbing of scars on its right side shows up clearly. His eyes are gray, so pale they seem almost colorless. As I write about 409, I find myself stirred by the same passion that stirs my heroine. I begin to feel uneasy, so I stop and drink some tea. I can see I'm going to have trouble with 409. It's never wise to get too involved with one's characters. Besides, I'm not his type. I imagine the way he'd look at me, indifference evident on his dark, scarred face. I could, of course, kill him off. My heroine would then spend the rest of the story avenging him, though she'd never get to the real murderer, me. But this solution, while popular among writers, is unfair. I go into the kitchen, extract a carrot from a bunch in the icebox, clean it, and eat it. After that, I write the heroine's reunion with 409. Neither of them is demonstrative. They greet each other with apparent indifference and retire to bed. I skip the next scene. How can I watch that red-headed hussy in bed with the man I'm beginning to love? I continue the story at the moment when the alarm bell rings and they awake to find the warlord's rocket planes have landed all around their hideout. A desperate situation. 409 suggests that he make a run for it in their rocket plane. While the warlord's minions pursue him, my heroine can sneak away in the power sledge. The plan has little chance of success, but they can think of none better. They bid farewell to one another, and my heroine goes to wait in the sledge for the signal telling her 409 has taken off. As she waits, smoking a cigar, she thinks of what little she knows about 409. He was a fighter pilot in the war against the Martian colony and was shot down and captured. While in prison, something happened to him that he either can't remember or refuses to talk about. And when the war ended and he was released, he became a criminal. As for herself, she had been an ordinary sharpshooter and a student of Hindu mysticism, and a follower of Swami Bluestone of the Brooklyn Vedic Temple and Wrestle Range. Then she discovered by accident the warlord's plot to overthrow the government of Titan's plot, the only one of Saturn's satellites not under his control. With her information about the plot, the government failed to save the plot. She had to get Titan City with the microfilm guy to Titan City with the microfilm. The alarm bell rings, and she feels the ground shake. 409's plane takes off. As 409's plane takes off, I'm writing the story from my heroine's point of view. I'm writing the story from my heroine's point of view. I want the warlord's plot. Planes taking the warlord to him, chasing him as he flies through the narrow twisting valleys. Planes rocket to flaring red in the valley shadows, and flaring red in the empty yellow fireballs, exploding all the fireballs. 409 scarred with a sweet tranquil, and his hands move quickly and surely over the plane's controls, and surely over the steel prosthetic hand gleams the dim light from the dial. But I can't put this in the story. But I can't hear it when it sees none of it. Since my hero went off in the opposite direction, spies off down a narrow trail, hidden by overhanging cliffs. I am beginning to feel tense. I don't know why. Possibly 409's dilemma is disturbing me. 409's dilemma is certainly in danger. In any case, my tea is cold. In any case, I turn on the radio, hoping for some relaxing rock music and go to get more tea. But it's 20 to the hour, time for the news, and I get the weekend body count. 2 men found dead in suspected West Side dope house, naked body of woman dragged out of Detroit River. I hurry back and switch to a country music station. On it, someone's singing about how he intends to leave the big city and go back down south. As I go back into the kitchen, I think, carry me back to Titan. That's where I want to be. I want to repose on the methane snows at the edge of a frozen sea. I pour out the old tea and refill the cup with tea that's hot. The radio begins to make that awful beepity-beep, beepity-beep sound that warns you the news is coming up. I switch back to the rock station, where the news is now over. I'm safe for another 55 minutes, unless there's a special news flash to announce a five-car pileup or an especially ghastly murder. The plan works. For my heroine, at least. She doesn't know yet if 409 got away. She speeds off unpursued. The power sludge's heating system doesn't quite keep her warm, and the landscape around her is forbidding. Bare cliffs and narrow valleys full of methane snow. Overhead, the dark blue sky. Saturn has set, and the tiny sun is rising, though she can't see it yet. On the high mountains, the ice fields begin to glitter with its light. On she races, remembering how she met 409 in the slums of the Cup on Ganymede as she fled the warlord's assassins. She remembers being cornered with no hope of escape. Then, behind the two assassins, a tall figure appeared and the shining steel hand smashed down on the back of one assassin's head. As the other assassin turned, he got the hand across his face. A moment or two more and both the assassins were on the ground unconscious. Then she saw 409's twisted grin for the first time and his colorless eyes appraising her. There I go, I think. Getting all heated up over 409. The radio is beginning to bother me, so I shut it off and relight my cigar. I find myself wishing that men like 409 really existed. Increasingly, in recent years, I found real men boring. Is it possible, as some scientists argue, that the Y chromosome produces an inferior human being? There certainly seem to be far fewer interesting men than interesting women. But theories arguing that one kind of human being is naturally inferior make me anxious. I feel my throat muscles tightening and the familiar, tense, numb feeling spreading across my face and my upper back. Quickly, I return to my story. Now, out on the snowy plain, my heroine can see the transparent domes of Titan City ahead of her, shining in the pale sunlight. Inside the domes, the famous pastel towers rise, their windows reflecting the sun. The power sledge speeds down the road, through the drifts that half cover it. Snow sprays up on either side of the sledge, so my heroine has trouble seeing to the left and right. As a result, it's some time before she sees the power sledges coming up behind her on the right. At the same moment that she looks over and sees them, their sleek silver bodies shining in the sunlight and snow spray shooting up around them, her radio begins to go beep, beep, beep. She flicks it on. The voice of Janos Black, the warlord's chief agent on Titan, harsh and slurred by a thick Martian accent, tells her the bad news. 409's plane has been shot down. He ejected before it crashed. Even now, the warlord's men are going after the ejection capsule, which is high on a cliff, wedged behind a rock spire and the cliff wall. Janos offers her a trade. 409 for the microdot. But Janos may well be lying. 409 may have gotten away or else been blown up. She feels a sudden constriction of her throat at the thought of 409 dead. She flicks off the radio and pushes the power sledge up to top speed. She realizes as she does so that 409 is unlikely to fare well if Janos gets a hold of him. Janos' wife and children died of thirst after the great Martian network of pipelines was blown apart by Earth bombs, and Janos knows that 409 was a pilot in the Earther Expeditionary Force. I write another exciting chase, this one across the snowy plain, toward the pink, green, blue, and yellow towers of Titan City. The warlord's power sledges are gaining. Their rockets hit all around my heroine's sledge, and fire and black smoke erupt out of the snow. Swearing in a low monotone, she swings the sledge back and forth in a zigzag, evasive pattern. I stop to puff on my cigar and discover it's gone out again. My tea is cold. But the story's beginning at last to interest me. I keep on writing. As my heroine approaches the entrance to Titan City, she's still a short distance ahead of her pursuers. Her radio beeps. It's Janos Black again. He tells her his men have gotten to the ejection capsule and are lowering it down the cliff. Any minute now, they'll have it downed where they can open it and get 409 out. Ignoring Janos, she concentrates on slowing her sledge and bringing it through the city's outer gate into the airlock. A moment or two later, she's safe. But what about 409? Frankly, I don't know. I stand and stretch, decide to take a bath, and go to turn the water on. The air pollution must be worse than I originally thought. I have the dopey feeling I get on the days when the pollution is really bad. I look out the window. Dark gray smoke is still coming out of the chimneys across the street. Maybe I should call the air control number. Dial AIRCARE and complain. But it takes a peculiar kind of person to keep on being public-spirited after it becomes obvious it's futile. I decide to put off calling air control and water my plants instead. Every bit of oxygen helps, I think. I check the bathtub. It's not yet half full. And go back to writing. After a couple of transitional paragraphs, my heroine finds herself in the antechamber to the Titans Council's meeting room. There's a man there, standing with his back to her. He's tall and slender, and his long hair is a shade between blonde and gray. He turns, and she recognizes the pale, delicate-looking face. This is Michael Stellodoro, the warlord of Saturn's moons. His eyes, she notices, are as blue as cornflowers, and he has a delightful smile. He congratulates her on escaping his power sledges, then tells her that his men have gotten 409 out of the ejection capsule. He is still alive, and as far as they can determine, uninjured. They have given 409 a shot of sofamine. At this, my heroine gasps with horror. Sofamine, she knows, is an extremely powerful tranquilizer used to control schizophrenia. One dose is enough to make most people dependent on it, and withdrawal takes the form of a nightmarish psychotic fugue. The warlord smiles his delightful smile and turns on the radio he has clipped to his belt. A moment later, my heroine hears 409's voice telling her that he has in fact been captured. He sounds calm and completely uninterested in the situation. That, she knows, is the sofamine. It hasn't affected his perception of reality. He knows where he is and what is likely to happen to him, but he simply doesn't care. When the sofamine wears off, all the suppressed emotions will well up, so intense that the only way he'll be able to deal with him will be to go insane. Temporarily, at least. The warlord tells her he regrets having to use the sofamine, but he was certain that 409 would refuse to talk unless he was either drugged or tortured, and there simply wasn't enough time to torture him. "You fiend!" my heroine cries. The warlord smiles again, as delightfully as before, and says if she gives the microdot to the Titan Council, he will turn 409 over to Janos Black, who will attempt to avenge on him all the atrocities committed by the Earthers on Mars. What can she do? As she wonders, the door to the meeting room opens, and she is asked to come in. For a moment, she thinks of asking the Titans to arrest the warlord. Almost as if he's read her mind, he tells her there's no point in asking the Titanians to arrest him. He has diplomatic immunity and a war fleet waiting for him to return. She turns to go into the meeting room. "I'll tell Janos the good news," the warlord says softly and turns his radio on. She hesitates, then thinks, "A man this evil must be stopped, no matter what the cost." She goes into the meeting room. I remember the bathwater. Leap up and run into the bathroom. The tub is brimful and about to overflow. I turn off the tap, let out some of the water, and start to undress. After I climb into the tub, I wonder how I'm going to get 409 out of the mess he's in. Something will occur to me. I grab the bar of soap floating past my right knee. After bathing, I put on a pink and silver muumuu and make a fresh pot of tea. Cleanliness is next to godliness. I think, as I sit down to write. My heroine tells her story to the Titan Council and produces the Microdot. On it is the warlord's plan for taking over the government of Titan and a list of all the Titanian officials he has subverted. The president of the council thanks her kindly and tells her that they already have a copy of the Microdot, obtained for them by an agent of theirs who has infiltrated the warlord's organization. "Oh no," my heroine cries. Startled, the president asks her what's wrong. She explains that she has sacrificed her partner, her love, to bring them information they already had. "Rest easy," the president says. "Our agent is none other than Janos Black. He won't harm 409. Thinking of Janos's family dying of thirst in an isolated settlement, my heroine feels none too sure of this. But there's nothing left for her to do except hope. After that, I describe her waiting in Titan City for news, wandering restlessly through the famous gardens, barely noticing the beds of Martian sandflowers, the blossoming magnolia trees, the ponds of enormous silver carp. Since the warlord now knows that the Titan Council knows about his schemes, the council moves quickly to answer the officials he subverted. The newscasts are full of scandalous revelations, and the warlord leaves Titan for his home base, another one of Saturn's moons. My heroine pays no attention to the newscasts or to the excited conversations going on all around her. She thinks of the trip she and 409 made from Ganymede to Titan in a stolen moonhopper, remembering 409's hands on the ship's controls, the way he moved in zero-G, his colorless eyes, and his infrequent, twisted smile. Cornball, I think, but leave the passage in. I enjoy thinking about 409 as much as my heroine does. After 2 days, Janos Black arrives in a police plane. 409 is with him. Janos comes to see my heroine to bring her the news of their arrival. He's a tall man with a broad chest and spindly arms and legs. His face is ruddy and Slavic, and his hair is prematurely white. He tells her that he has kept 409 prisoner in the warlord's secret headquarters in the Titanian Mountains till the Titanian police moved in and arrested everybody. "Then he's all right," she cries joyfully. Janos shakes his head. "Why not?" "The sofamine," Janos explains. "When it wore off, he got hit with the full force of all his repressed feelings. Especially, I think, the feelings he had about the war on Mars. Think of all that anger and terror and horror and guilt flooding into his conscious mind. He tried to kill himself. We stopped him, and he almost killed a couple of us in the process. By we, I mean myself and the warlord's men. This happened before the police moved in. We had to give him another shot of sofamine. He's still full of the stuff. From what I've heard, the doctors want to keep giving it to him. They think the first shot of sofamine he got destroyed his old system of dealing with his more dangerous emotions, which are now overwhelming him. The doctors say on sofamine he can function more or less normally. Off it, they think he'll be permanently insane." "You planned this," she cries. Janos shakes his head. "The warlord gave the order, miss. I only obeyed it. But I didn't mind this time. I didn't mind." I stop to drink some tea. Then I write the final scene in the chapter. My heroine's meeting with 409. He's waiting for her in a room at the Titan City Hospital. The room is dark. He sits by the window, looking out at the tall towers, blazing with light, and at the dome above them, which reflects the tower's light, so it's impossible to look through it at the sky. She can see his dark shape and the red tip of the cigar he smokes. "Do you mind if I turn on the lights?" she asks. "No." She finds the button and presses it. The ceiling begins to glow. She looks at 409. He lounges in his chair, his feet up on a table. She realizes it's the first time she's seen him look really relaxed. Before this, he always seemed tense, even when asleep. "How are you?" she asks. "Fine." His voice sounds tranquil and indifferent. She can't think of anything to say. He looks at her, his dark, scarred face expressionless. Finally, he says, "Don't let it bother you. I feel fine." He pauses. She still can't think of anything to say. He continues, "The pigs don't want me for anything here on Titan. I think I'll be able to stay." "What are you going to do here?" "Work, I guess. The doctors say I can hold down a job if I keep taking sulfamine." He draws on the cigar, so the tip glows red, then blows out the smoke. He keeps looking away from her at the towers outside the window. She begins weeping. He looks back at her. "I'm all right. Believe me, I feel fine." But she can't stop weeping. Enough for today, I think, and put the cover back on my typewriter. Tomorrow, I'll figure out a way to get 409 off sulfamine. Where there's life, there's hope, and so forth, I tell myself.
And that was The Warlord of Saturn's Moons, a science fiction short story by Eleanor Arneson. And it's read to us by Professor Ginger Kitty. Hey, Professor. I got her on the
Hello,
phone.
Hello, Fortunato.
Hi.
Doing well. Happy birthday.
Well, thank you. And as a treat, I treated myself with that short story, which we read, 2 years ago, it seems like now. Yeah.
Yeah, almost.
Yeah. I've got the professor on the phone here because I just wanted to get your thoughts on the passing of movie icon, probably the last great movie star, Lauren Bacall.
Wasn't she so sophisticated, so cool, so collected, so intelligent, and so sexy?
It still comes through today from those movies from long ago.
Absolutely. That was when women were portrayed as being, where their minds and their wit, their savvy, were as important as their appearance.
Yeah, it was.
She was a very beautiful woman.
What was that one in San Francisco that we liked? Dark Passage?
Dark Passage. Oh, that's wonderful. She's terrific in that because she's really the only star for the first, 20 minutes before you see him?
Yeah.
See his face?
We're like, what are her reasonings? Why is she taking a chance like this?
And didn't it seem as though people were more adult then? I mean, as you say, she was only 19. Maybe she was like 21 or 2 when she made Dark Passage, but they seemed like grown up.
Yeah. Have you heard any of this radio series before, Bold Venture?
No, and I love radio shows from that time. I never even heard of this one.
They recorded about 37 of them, and then Bogart went off and did The African Queen, and then they came back and they did maybe about 57 more or something like that. And
the two of them together, Bogart and Bacall, did that many shows?
Yeah, they did it for a while. Bogart kind of got bored with it, and so they kind of drifted off. But they did quite a bit, and they're available online. I'm like,
what are the stories like?
Sometimes they're in the back streets of Havana, or they're out on the high seas of the Caribbean, or a desert island. And it's kind of like
Hemingway-ish.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, yes, it's very much like To Have and Have Not. They don't make movies like that anymore, do they? With women
she
like
would,
that.
She wouldn't just stand by her man, though. She would outrun him some of the time.
And she would, like, out-sarcasm him, too, as well.
Yeah, I like that. Out-think him.
Yes. Well, we've been talking with Professor Ginger Kitty out there in Ithaca, New York, and she's going to settle back right now because it's now time for Bold Venture with Humphrey Bogart and Lauren Bacall. Tonight's story, 4 Invitations to Death.
Can he lift his feet, sailor?
I'm trying, but Mr. Johnson's left foot is heavier than his right. It throws me off balance.
Now, come on, let's get him into my bed. You know, you can help too, Mrs. Johnson.
I was afraid you were going to ask me that. Imagine a husband of mine fainting in the lobby of a hotel. John Johnson, Jr. Jr. 50 years old and doesn't know how to behave in a hotel lobby. You do it. I can't touch him. gorges himself with food and faints. Fat.
Fat he is. I can't even tell whether the shin bone's connected to the ankle bone. Or the ankle bone's connected to the...
Stop beating your gums, comedian. Just open the door to my room.
I'll do it. See? I helped.
You're a clever one, Mrs. Johnson. Okay, Junior. Up. There. Sleep tight. Come on, let's leave him alone. I'll send him home to you in the morning, Mrs. Johnson.
I can hardly wait. Send my husband home. We're staying at the Pacifica Hotel. I'll wait for him breathlessly.
Now, there's a woman a man can admire, sailor. Marries a man, obviously a wealthy man, then she can't stand the sight of him. Shows she has a mind of her own. That's good in a woman. That's what makes me admire women so much. Take you now.
Oh, you're just saying that because I put my hair up last night. You're such a...
A man brought this letter, Mr. Slate. Said to give it to you right away.
Oh, thanks, King. Is the man waiting for an answer?
No, gave me the letter and scurried into the wild blue yonder.
Read this, sailor.
Goodbye, Shannon. Goodbye, dead man. Who gave you this, King?
A man I never saw before, Lady Sailor. He gave me the...
The letter and scurried into the wild blue yonder. I'll forget it. It's a new way of collecting bills. Hook me up a hammock on the patio, King. I'm going to sleep.
Señor Morel, without a coat in this high place, you will become sick. The ocean winds eat through your bone.
Worried about me, Pedro?
You are a man, senor, whose brain molders with his sorrow. And for this, a man must crawl before you. And other men die.
Two so far. I've killed only two. You delivered the message?
Si.
To Shannon?
To his servant.
Good, that's polite. An invitation to death should be polite.
If you have no more need of me...
No, stay here. I want you to look out at the sea with me. How lovely it is, how calm. And my wife sleeps in it. There where the moon touches a white crest. How long ago, Pedro? You tell me, how long?
6 years. 6 years since your wife drowned. You always count the days for me. It is 6 years.
6 years since you and Shannon, the other two, murdered her. Threw her from the life raft so you filth could live.
She was washed over by a wave. How many times must I tell you, madman? The fishing boat was wrecked in a storm. We got into the life raft. We five, a wave washed her over. We tried to...
You think she sleeps in peace, Pedro? I hope so. I've killed two for her. And now there's Shannon. And then there'll be you.
Come on, Slate, wake up.
Oh,
I know she is, Slate. But tell her to go away. Wake up.
Oh, dear.
That's what you get for sleeping out here in a hammock. It's almost 8 o'clock and the rooster's on the wing. Are you going to wake up?
Oh, dear.
Okay.
Hey, well, what's the matter with you? Going out of your mind? What'd you dump me out of the hammock for? What... Hey, what was that?
Get off your back, Slate. Something's happening in the hotel.
Mr. Slate, in your room, quickly.
Slate, look at him.
Yeah. Dead. Shot 3 times. What happened, King?
I was fixing breakfast, Mr. Slate. Heard the shots, ran into your room and saw Mr. Johnson like you see him.
Call the police, sailor, and wait around for them.
What about you?
I'm going to wake up a lady. Maybe she can tell me why she's a widow.
Good morning, Mr. Shannon. I see you didn't bring my husband with you. Thanks. Come on in.
All right. Your husband couldn't come with me, Mrs. Johnson.
I'm having orange juice. Would you like me to squeeze you an orange?
Your husband's dead.
Junior? Oh.
Doesn't throw you, huh?
Why should it?
Oh, I don't know. Crazy custom, I guess. Woman's husband dies. I had the notion women cry about things like that. Dumb me.
Cry for that pig? He chomped his way into his grave. I warned him.
He was shot to death. Shot 3 times.
Well, that's picturesque.
Yeah, real romantic. Is this all it does to you, Mrs. Johnson?
The Mrs. part is only an affectation now. If we're going to talk anymore, just call me Rita. All the boys will from now on.
Just one more thing. Why should anyone want to kill your husband?
Well, I know why.
You want to tell me or the police?
Mm-hmm. You're prettier. My husband was killed to make me happy. I'm young, attractive, and... Don't you think I'm attractive?
Let's just say you're tall.
About your size.
And now you're going to be rich. Is that what you're trying to tell me?
Gorgeously rich. Does that interest you? No? Get out of here, Mr. Shannon. Anything else I can do for you, LaSalle?
Let me check my list. We have removed the body of Senor John Johnson, Jr. Check. We have photographed fingerprints. Check. We have et cetera, check, et cetera, check. Ah, this I have not done.
Lucky for you, I brought it up, huh? What haven't you done?
To inform Senor Shannon that the instant he puts a foot in his hotel here, he is to take his foot and bring it up to my office, to the police.
I'll tell him. You want the rest of him, too, besides his foot?
But the very instant. It is a matter of...
I'll tell him.
Do not disappoint me, or your Shannon, senorita. Adios.
Oh, perdón, senor.
Cuidado.
Your pardon for my bumping into your walking body, senor. Perdón.
De nada.
If that one would only throw me his business one day, he would make a name for me. Give me the back of your hand, senorita. I will kiss it for you.
All right.
Deliciosa.
Tasty, huh?
Oh, delicious, delicious. Mm. You should come in cans. Senorita, you have just had the honor of being kissed by Timbro, the undertaker.
Give me back my hand.
Yeah, take it. This is not what I come for. Please to show me the dead body of Slade Shannon, huh? And I will take it away and do my utmost to give calm, satisfactory, reasonable service. If you like, we can arrange a layaway plan, small down payment, anything that you would...
Oh, there's the body walking in now. Go collect him.
That is Slade Shannon? But he looks like a man who has not yet kicked the bucket. I cry, I've been deceived. This is impossible.
And what's the little man crying for, sailor? You say something to hurt his feelings?
I just proved to him you weren't dead. Broke his heart. Hold out your hand so he can kiss it. Maybe that'll make him feel better.
What goes on with you when I'm out, sailor? Who is this guy?
Timbro, the undertaker. You should hear his offer. Give him the pitch, Tiny Tim.
But, senor, you are not dead. I have been made of a fool. Somebody called me on the phone. Promise me that you are dead. Promise to give me your business. They promised me. And I need the money so badly.
I'm sorry I can't help you, Tiny Tim. Over there is out.
You cannot order me. The man said that you are dead.
You go break his heart too, Tim.
Put me down, senor. Put me down. Put... Teach, you are really alive, huh?
Bye, Tiny Tim.
We'll report this to the association. I will report...
Don't bother to take off your coat, Slate. You've got a date.
Guy tells me I'm dead and you want to go dancing.
Not me, LaSalle. They tell me he's got a bunny hug that'll open your eyes. Let's go try it on, huh, Slate?
You, senorita, make yourself lovely in my wicker chair. It is my only piece of furniture that becomes you.
Ever caught me on a desk? It'd make a peachy police calendar.
In the wicker chair, so that when the fright overtakes you, you can bury your head in its arms.
Fright? What are you talking about, LaSalle?
Just that. And you, senor, you will take it standing up, I presume. Because you imagine yourself an invulnerable man.
No, he doesn't. Show him your collection of scars, Slate.
Soon there may be the permanent scar on him, Senorita Duval. The scar of death.
Thanks for putting the wicker chair under me.
This your day to play goblin, LaSalle? What are you talking about?
2 weeks ago, a man was murdered. A plain man, Juan Rico. A week later, another man was murdered.
So you had a couple of good weeks. What's that got to do with Slate?
I will come to it. 4 men have been promised death. 2 have got it.
That murder note someone sent me, it was for real. That's what you're trying to say?
Precisely. The killer, Johnson Jr., thought it was you sleeping in your own bed. He thought he killed you.
Slate, that makes you...
Precisely. 2 are dead, and there is still a 3rd and a 4th. Walk quietly, Navana, Senor Shannon. The 3rd death waits for you.
You're listening to another episode of Bold Venture. We're going to take a quick musical interlude with...
Maybe it happens this way.
Lauren Bacall.
Maybe we really belong together, but after all, how little we know. Maybe it's just for a day. Love is as changeable as the weather, and after all, how little we know. Who knows why an April breeze never remains. Why stars in the trees hide when it rains. Love comes along, casting a spell. Will it sing you a song? Maybe you're meant to be mine. Maybe I'm only supposed to stay in your arms a while, as others have done. Is this what I've waited for? Am I the one? Oh, I hope in my heart that it's so. In spite of all little we know.
Call from the movie To Have and Have Not. And now, Act 2 of tonight's Bold Venture, 4 Invitations to Death, with Humphrey Bogart and Lauren Bacall.
In Shannon's place, a man lay him down in a bed not his own, on face a frown. His indigestion to sleep away, but he wake with little bullets that come to stay. He die in Mr. Shannon's now angered bed, make scarlet the pillow with his blood so red. Then police they say, it big mistake, not him but Mr. Shannon is who death should take.
3 cheers and a rackety racks for the Havana Police Department. Turn a back somersault and lead me in a cheer, sailor.
What makes you so sour, Slate? They're trying to save your life.
Yeah, but how? They want me to get out of Havana. Maybe I never told you this, sailor. I'm crazy about Havana.
It's only for a little while, till they find the murderer. Someone wants you dead, and you want to walk up to him and shake his hand. Because in some rotten port once, maybe a girl whispered you were a hero.
Correction. In all the rotten ports. I'm not going to run.
It has always been so with him, lady sailor. I remember once in Vina del Mar... Suddenly I remember another thing that I have not remembered. This letter came for you, Mr. Slate, while you were at the police.
Well, let's see. Just like the other one you handed me, King. The first one, the one that said...
You've been asking for it. Open it.
Look what it says, sailor. You were once fortunate, Shannon. You will never be again.
You're going to sit here and wait for it, Slate?
You think I'm nuts? I'm going to share it with LaSalle. That's what he's getting paid for, to keep me alive. Now, if you go with me, sailor, you might get hurt.
Ain't it always like that, Buster? Let's go. Yes?
Are you Mrs. Johnson?
Was. Why?
Would you mind if I came in?
Of course you can come in.
I want to look at you.
I'll stand in front of these dressing mirrors and you can look at me 4 ways. Like me?
What manner of woman are you?
I don't know. What don't you like about me, Mr.,
Morrell. Charles Morrell.
What do you want, Charlie?
I thought to look at you. I thought to see how a woman grieves, and finally to give you my condolences.
Oh, you mean about Fatso getting killed, my husband? Mm-hmm. Oh, you dear boy.
You're not sorry he's dead? The fact that a man pumped 3 bullets into him leaves you like this?
Dear, dear boy. Fatso had 3 bullets in him, huh?
Yes.
That's right, he did. But the papers didn't say so, dear boy.
What?
You killed Junior?
Mrs. Johnson...
That's one way you'd know he was shot 3 times. You kill him?
It was a mistake. I thought he was someone else. I thought he was...
Slate Shannon. I don't like that fellow either. You miss Slate Shannon, Charlie. That's a shame.
My wife was drowned 6 years ago. For the first time, I'm looking at another woman. Looking. I've almost stopped grieving. But not quite.
Because there's still Shannon? Huh? Then go away. Come back when your mind's all clear. I'll wait for you.
I cannot do what you ask of me, Shannon. I will not reveal to you the 4th man on the death list.
And you know who he is.
See, we know who he is.
If you tell me who he is, where he is, maybe we can save each other's life. Maybe he can tell me why someone wants him and me dead. Maybe he can explain about the notes, why I have to die with guys I never saw before, never knew.
That's my slate. Got A in elocution.
Deservedly. Shannon, we do not know where this 4th man is. If we told you his name, you with your friendships in Havana might find him. And because you found him, lead the killer to him. Obviously, the killer knows where you are. For the other man, there is still a chance.
And for Slate, a paper lily, huh?
Oh, we will do our best. Hey. Pedro Avarillo.
You said something. It sounded like...
Pedro Avarillo. A pitiful little thief who is hidden away from us by his friends in the barrio because they think we wish to arrest him for snatching purses. When all we want is that he should live out his life in comfort for many years in our jails. The barrio shrugs, laughs, spits, and tells us nothing.
That's funny. Me, they chew my ears off. Come on, sailor. And thanks, LaSalle. Maybe I can bring us back alive.
Mi alma, oh, my soul, mi hermosa, my beautiful. Try to put your arms around Fat Maria, huh? You won't make it, but he will give me a few shivers, huh?
You don't change, Maria.
You come for a night of dance? All polkas are on the house for you.
You haven't had a polka since that Romanian put you on a diet. Now we want Pedro Avarillo. You know where he is?
The police want him, too. Maybe I don't give him to you, because suddenly you are the color of police.
It's true what the police say, Maria. Someone's trying to kill Pedro. Slate, too. Maybe Slate can change that.
From your lips, I believe it. The Las Cantinas Hotel is the dirtiest with the most rats. With the most...
Yeah, with Pedro. Let's go open up a new world for him, sailor. Pedro! Open up, Pedro! I guess he's not here, sailor.
He's here.
Huh? Sailor, looking through keyholes, that's not Cricket Girl. Here, let me look.
In that chair by the window. See? Paper in his lap. Like he fell asleep.
Yeah. Pedro! Watch out, sailor. Wake up, Pedro. Wake up.
Slate, look. In his back.
Yeah. Knife to death. Wait a minute.
Let's get out of here.
Uh-huh, yeah.
Yeah, what?
I know this guy. 6 years ago, I saw this man.
on a life raft.
A life raft?
Uh-huh. It was an all-day deep-sea fishing excursion. I was new to Havana, so I went with the tourists. The boat was loaded, about 20 too many people on it when the storm came up. The boat sank. Him, me, and a couple of other men wound up in a small rubber life raft. And a woman. Yeah. Yeah, that's it.
It is? What is?
The woman. She drowned. She got tossed overboard by a wave. We tried to save her, but in that rough sea...
What's all this got to do with those killings?
That woman. I met her husband at the inquiry. He started to beat on my chest, threatened me, said the four of us drowned her. I couldn't blame him at the time.
And maybe the time is now. Revenge. Is that what you mean?
Let's walk around Havana, sailor. Maybe we can find out.
Can't we go home now, Slate? We've been walking Havana for 5 hours.
Hey, come on, turn this corner. Now, look over your shoulder. See a man in a straw hat and a cane?
No. Wait a minute. Yes, he just came around the same corner we did.
Come on.
Was he the man who's looking for us, Slate? That drowned woman's husband?
I don't know. I wouldn't know if I saw him up close.
But you saw him at the inquiry.
Oh, for about 10 seconds. His face was twisted with grief. It's been 6 years ago. Here, in this building, sailor.
What's in here?
An elevator that goes 5 stories up to a roof. If the guy in the straw hat isn't our boy, we'll get a fine view of Havana Harbor. Someone's got the elevator up on the second floor. Ring the bell and bring it down.
Just as long as you let me ring your elevator bells, I'm happy.
Wait for me.
I almost got away from you, mister.
Thank you.
The floor, please.
I don't want to inconvenience you two. You were on this elevator first. Take it wherever you're going.
Well, we were going to the top, to the roof.
Why, so was I. It's a fine time to look at the boats. All lighted up, and the fishermen making port.
Yes, it's quite a sight for them that likes it. Third floor, tots clothing, beanies, six-shooters.
Pardon me, mister, it's the altitude.
Charming. Well, here we are.
Watch your step, please.
Don't I know you, mister?
Indeed you do. Very well. You knew my wife, too.
The woman who drowned?
Out there in the ocean.
I couldn't be helped.
You all tried to tell me that? The whimperings of dying men?
Pedro Avrillo didn't have a chance to whimper. He was stabbed in the back.
And you whimper. Whimper, plead for your life, Shannon. You're the last one.
Slate, watch him. He's got a knife.
Come and get me, mister.
You'll whimper. You'll whimper.
Did you hear anything yet, mister?
Last one.
Watch that blade, sonny. Watch it. Hey, son. This won't hurt a bit.
Stop it, Slate. You'll kill him. Slate. What did you want to do? Beat him to death?
That's insurance, baby. That way I stay alive.
Get me out of here.
What's the matter? Don't you like the harbor?
Just get me out of here.
Go home. I'll see this guy meets the cops. Go home. I'll meet you back at Shannon's place.
Slate.
What?
I just want to tell you how much I like it.
No wonder. You look good aboard the Bold Venture. I like it, too.
Where are you taking me?
Well, I'm not taking you anywhere. I'm running across the channel for repairs. The carburetor's coughing.
So give it cough medicine. You can fix a carburetor.
All right. So I wanted to take a boat ride.
Come here, Slate. Close your eyes. That's right. That's why you wanted to take a boat ride, isn't it?
You found me out. That makes me a cad. Come here.
Be careful, Slate. You're rocking the boat.
You crazy? I never rock boats.
So a little publicity is going to hurt you? Do it again, Slate.
You've been listening to Humphrey Bogart and Lauren Bacall in another episode of Bold Venture, Four Invitations to Death. We'll be back again next month on Gremlin Time. Stay tuned for Joe Woods and the Tiki Cha-Cha Club right here on your favorite community radio station, KBOO Portland.
Stay tuned for the Tiki Cha Cha Club.
Glad to see you all aboard.
Ole, ole, it's show time.
In the tiki 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 room, in the tiki 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 room,
all the birds sing birds and the flowers croon.
In the tiki 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 room.
Welcome to our tropical hideaway, you lucky people, you. If we weren't in the show starting right away, we'd sing the audience too.
All together in the tiki 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 room, in the tiki 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 room.
All the birds sing word and the flowers croon.
In the tiki 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 room.
Our show is delightful, we hope you'll agree. We hope that it fills you with pleasure and glee. Because if we don't make you feel like that, we're gonna wind up on the lady's hat.
In the tiki 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 room, in the tiki 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 room,
all the birds sing words and the flowers croon.
In the tiki 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 room,
oh it's a load
up. In the tiki 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 room, in the tiki 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 room, all the birds sing words and the flowers croon. In the tiki 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 room.